Let's see. Do we have anyone who's here for the very first time tonight? Well, a couple of people. Okay, glad to have you here. We're going to be jumping into some fairly difficult material tonight. I hope you get something out of it. There's going to be a lot of me running my mouth up here tonight, trying to run through a lot of didactic material that we'll talk about in more detail next week. But let's begin with some prayers. So we can get the gold prayer book and turn to the daily prayers on page 34. And I've talked a little bit about the taking refuge and generating bodhicitta prayer and the four immeasurables prayer. So now just a little bit of commentary on the seven limb prayer. That's a very common prayer in Tibetan Buddhism. There are lots of different versions of it. By seven limbs, it refers to the seven lines that are always included, various activities that we do that you could say they create merit or positive karma, or they help soften our minds so that we get more from the teachings that are to follow. All these prayers are the ones we do before teachings or before we do a meditation session on our own. And they're all for the purpose of preparing our mind. As we've talked about, Buddhism is a non-theistic religion, so we're not really praying to anyone outside ourselves. We're working with our mind. And everything in Buddhism is about working with our mind, and that's why in the Discovering Buddhism series, we start with the module on mind and its potential. So the first line, reverently I prostrate with my, I'll just read these two first and then we'll say them together. Reverently I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. So we often do prostrations as a way of accumulating positive karma. It's also a way of combating pride and arrogance. When we do physical prostrations, we actually touch our head to the floor. Here we're doing mental prostrations. We're imagining that we're bowing with our body, our speech, and our mind. Second line is, I present clouds of every type of offering. So we imagine that we're presenting everything wonderful in the universe that we can think of, everything in the stores, everything that grows on the land, everything that exists in the sea. We're making incredible offerings. And who are we making these to? We're making these to the enlightened beings. Everyone who has followed this path in the past and has achieved a state of enlightenment, of completely developing their own qualities of compassion and wisdom. So first we're prostrating to the enlightened beings, then we're making offerings. Again, this is all done mentally. Then we confess. We declare all our negative actions accumulated since beginningless time. This means all our past negative actions of body, speech, and mind, both in this lifetime and if we believe in previous lifetimes, in those previous lifetimes. The next limb of the seven-limb prayer is rejoicing. And this is where we rejoice in the virtuous actions that we have done and that others have done also. It's said that by rejoicing when someone else does a virtuous action, we share in the positive karma that we've created. So it's very important to remember, this is something we forget lots of times, to rejoice. We get all hung up on all the negative things we've done, but we also have to rejoice in our positive actions of body, speech, and mind. Now, the next one, the next limb is requesting, please remain until the end of cyclic existence. Here we are mentally requesting to the enlightened beings, the Buddhas, to stay until the end of cyclic existence, which means it refers to samsara, this cycle of being born, getting old, getting sick, dying, and being reborn again. Because the Buddhas don't have to stay around. That's something they choose to do. Okay, so we're saying, please, don't go off into your Buddha nirvana, but stay here and teach us, which is what Buddhas can do. They can't save us. They can't remove our suffering or our negative karma, but they can teach us what they've learned as they've developed their own qualities of body, speech, and mind. So we're requesting them to stay and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings, and this is requesting them to teach. The phrase, turning the wheel of Dharma for living beings, means to teach. Okay, the first time the Buddha, the historical Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, who lived in India, first time he sat down and taught the monks who were followers, was referred to as the first turning of the wheel of Dharma. Dharma being anything that separates us from suffering. So any teaching that can help us end our own suffering is considered Dharma. And turning the wheel of Dharma is teaching it and offering it to others. And then, like we do in all our meditation sessions, I dedicate my own merits and those of everyone else, okay? So I dedicate the positive energy I've created and the positive energy that others have created, not just to my enlightenment, but to the enlightenment of all living beings. So those are the limbs of the seven-limb prayer, a very traditional sort of Buddhist prayer. And then we'll, the mandala offering, which is just really elaborating the second limb, presenting more offerings. We've talked about that a little bit, and we'll talk about that one some more next week. So we'll begin by saying our prayers. We'll read Refuge and Bodhicitta together three times. We'll read the Four Immeasurables, the seven-limb prayer, the mandala offering with the hand mudra. If you've figured that one out yet, if you can't do it, don't worry about it. And the other prayers we do with our hands at our hearts, our thumbs touching, representing the union of wisdom and compassion. And again, we're doing these prayers, not praying to a divine, all-powerful being, but to make positive impressions on our own mind. And it's said they're like tilling the soil when the seeds of the teachings or the meditations are planted in the soil, so that the soil is more receptive. Reciting these prayers, our mind becomes more receptive to what is to follow. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Reverently I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginning and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. This ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun, and the moon. I imagine this as a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kam Niryatayami. And now we'll do our first meditation. Begin by establishing your posture. Your back a little bit straighter than you normally sit, but not rigid. Head straight on your shoulders, not tipped to one side or the other. Eyes either just very lightly closed or slightly open, but not focusing on anything. Mouth lightly closed, our tongue on the back of our upper gums above the teeth. Shoulders down and a little bit back so our chest is slightly open. Upper arms away from our torso so some air can pass into there. And we can either put our hands on our knees or our right hand and left with thumbs touching slightly below the navel. If we're sitting on a cushion, we're a little bit towards the front of the cushion. And our legs are in any position that we find comfortable, crossed or in various iterations of the lotus posture. If we're sitting on a chair, we're not slumped back in the chair, but again, our back is straight. Our feet are either flat on the floor, or if we need to put a cushion under our feet, that's fine. So take a minute and scan your body for any sources of tension or discomfort and address those now so that they don't become a distraction during the meditation. The point of the posture is to feel solid and grounded. The posture is self-preserving. It's not a source of distraction or something that we need to work at once it's been established, we can just ignore it and concentrate on our meditation. And now we'll take three deep breaths from the abdomen. The stomach expanding on the in-breath and contracting on the out-breath. So we're really filling our lungs completely. Now we allow our breathing to return to its normal pattern. And we take a moment and set our motivation for doing the meditation that is to follow. Any motivation is fine. If we're just doing this meditation to experiment or give it a try, that's great. If we're doing it because we know it helps us calm down a little bit and deal with the stress in our own life in a more positive manner, that's great. But it's said that the most powerful motivation, the one that gives the most force and energy to our meditation, is what's known as the bodhicitta motivation, the great mind motivation. The motivation that I am doing this meditation so that I can become enlightened and thereby be of benefit to all sentient beings, all living beings, all beings who experience suffering and problems. my family and friends, strangers, even those people I don't like. It seems rather grandiose to think that way, but if we can just think along those lines for a moment or two, that's a wonderful way to begin the meditation. And having set our motivation, we now begin the actual meditation, a very simple concentration meditation. The chosen object of the meditation is the movement of the breath in and out through our nostrils. The physical sensation of air moving in and out through the openings of our nose. And we just place our concentration, our awareness on that. Direct perception of breath moving in and out. We're not thinking about it. We're not describing it to ourselves. We're not visualizing it. Just direct perception of the movement of air, the physical sensation. And every time we notice that our concentration has wandered off to a sound or a memory or an itch or a to-do list, we drop that and bring our concentration back to the breath. Over and over and over again. And we can end our meditation with a brief dedication. Give ourselves a pat on the back, acknowledge we've done something positive, and we think, may that positive energy not be lost, not be dispersed, but may it ripen in the future in a way that benefits all sentient beings. And you can relax your concentration. Before we get into the material of tonight's class, any questions or comments about the prayers or the meditation we just did? Yeah, if you can wait for the mic, we've got a question over here.
I have two questions. The first is on the homework assignment, I guess it's the certificate sheet. It talks about meditating on the mind as knower.
Mm-hmm. That means as awareness, as being aware, as perceiving. I'm not giving you a specific meditation on that, so you can assume you've done that one.
Okay.
That's a freebie.
Okay.
Aaron?
May I ask another question? Could you say just briefly about the Buddhist philosophy that you don't want your mind to be dual?
Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's really not the subject of this course. Dualistic mind is a mind that sees me as separate from you, as separate from you. As separate from you, that there's me here and you out there. And there's this concept in Buddhism called interdependence, in which we see that everything is very connected, and that this dualistic, oppositic point of view is not really correct. It's a misperception of reality. And we'll talk about this some more in the class on emptiness. That's where it will really come up. Okay, but
thanks.
Dualism implies me here in a hard, fixed world out there that I'm interacting with. And the Buddhist point of view is that's really a misconception, in that everything that I'm perceiving ultimately comes from my own mind. There's no difference between the two. There's not me here and everything else out there. And that's the ultimate source of all our problems. Okay?
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. See, Aaron wanted to say something.
It's about the completion card.
Yeah.
So what we've always done, I guess, is handed out on the first class.
Mm-hmm.
However, it may or may not match what we're doing in class.
Yeah.
So what I've been doing is updating it as we go.
Mm-hmm.
So that by next week when we make copies, reflect what we've
done. And we'll go through it as a group, and I'll tell people which ones they can just are freebies, because
yeah,
I didn't think they were an important part of the class.
All right, so hang with us on that part of it.
Okay, okay. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions or comments? Yeah, we have one back here.
I have a question regarding suffering. It says that we can remove our suffering. But my question is, what about the physical suffering? Like, for example, and I'm talking about extreme situations. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, when someone is, like, being tortured. That would how come the mind cannot feel that suffering? That, mm-hmm. I mean, that physical suffering.
Mm-hmm.
Is that possible?
They say it is. It's not my experience. But you certainly hear stories like that. I mean, the first thing is, why do we suffer? Why do we experience suffering? Yeah. Could you give her the mic? Yeah. Okay, thanks.
I mean, if you get a broken leg, it's going to hurt and you're going to suffer,
right? Yeah, but why
do
you get a broken leg? I'm talking about from the Buddhist point of view. Karma, okay? At some point in the past, we've created the karma to have a broken leg. So the ultimate way to not suffer is to not create any karma that causes suffering. Okay, now that's way down the road, but certainly it's said that even in this lifetime we can develop our mind that even when we experience physical pain is not suffering. Okay?
And link it to this is like, I don't know where I don't know my actions 200 years ago
exactly.
In another life.
Yeah.
So is there a way that I can stop karma for happening in this life? Like maybe through meditation?
That's what we call purification practices.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll talk about that in the class on karma, which are practices we do like Vajrasattva mantra, prostrations, things like that that are said to purify that negative karma so we don't experience its results. We don't know what we did, but we can assume we've created a lot of karma in the past that will cause us to suffer. So that's purification practice. Any other questions? Okay. So I always like to review a little bit. We're talking about mind and its potential because everything in Buddhism is about developing our mind, is working with our mind and developing it. It's our mind, our consciousness, that becomes enlightened. Okay? It's not our body. Okay? We don't get enlightened by going to the gym and pumping iron. We become enlightened by working with our own mind, as messed up and as distorted as it may seem right now, and developing its qualities of compassion and wisdom. Compassion being the wish that others not suffer, wisdom being seeing reality accurately, seeing things as they are. So all we're doing is working with our mind to develop those two qualities completely, and that's what we refer to as enlightenment or Buddhahood. So it's very important if we're going to study Buddhism, if we're going to do all of the Discovering Buddhism modules, that we at least have a sense of what we're talking about when we talk about mind. And like a broken record, I said there are four qualities of mind that everybody needs to remember. If you don't get anything else out of this module, at least remember this. So the first one is non-physical. Mind or consciousness is that completely non-physical aspect of our being. It's related to the brain. It's related to our nervous system and the neurotransmitters, but the actual phenomena of consciousness, of mind, is completely non-physical. Okay? Second characteristic? Without beginning and without end. We can always find a previous moment of consciousness that precedes the current moment of consciousness, all the way back through this life. And according to the Buddhist philosophy, previous lifetimes without end. We cannot find a first moment of consciousness. We cannot find a moment when my mind began. It is without beginning. And in the same way, my consciousness and the consciousness of everyone in this room will continue into the future, through sleep tonight, through tomorrow when we get up, next year, through our old age. At death, our body decays, but our consciousness continues on into future lifetimes without end. No beginning, no end to consciousness. That applies to the consciousness of everyone in this room. Third characteristic is... No, not the function. Function's the last one. It's in the nature of clear light. It's in the nature of empty space. It's in the nature of a perfect mirror. That's another way to think. In that it has no other fixed qualities than what we're talking about. It is not, my mind is not depressed. It is an empty space in which depressed moments of thought can exist, But mind itself does not have that fixed quality. My mind is not angry. My mind is not impatient. Those may be thoughts that I have within the space of mind, but that is not permanently characteristic of my mind. That's just the nature of the moments of thought that occur in this space, like clouds passing through a perfectly blue sky. You know, it said there are 84,000 moments of consciousness within the snap of a finger. And each one of those has its own characteristics. But each one of those moments of thought is not the nature of my mind. Okay? And the fourth one is, its function is to perceive, to be aware, to perceive phenomena, things both out there and things that occur within my mind, my memories, plans, ideas, emotions. Those are all things that my mind is perceiving. Again, the idea of a mirror that's reflecting, the mind perceives. Okay, so those are the four characteristics of mind that's very important to remember. Any questions or comments about those? Okay. Let's see, then 2 weeks ago, we talked a little bit about, you know, who am I? Who am I, Robbie Watkins? How does the Buddha describe who I am? In the simplest way, is we can say Robbie is just a mind and a body that have come together for a period of time, temporarily, and that will separate. There's a mind and a body that come together. And onto those, we place the label of Robbie Watkins. If we look for Robbie, all we can find is a mind and a body. In the Buddhist concept, there's no soul. There's no permanent self. There's a mind which is constantly changing, a body which is constantly changing. They come together for a temporary period of time, and Robbie Watkins is, as Lama Zopa, one of our teachers, always says, merely labeled onto that combination, meaning there's nothing more to him than the label put on to the union of body and mind. Okay, so we can just say we're just a mind and a body. That's all we are. That's a very simplistic, but it's also a completely accurate point of view from Buddhist philosophy. But, of course, the Tibetan Buddhas, like, they've got to have their list. If they don't have their list, you know, they're just very unhappy. So body and mind is a little simple. So they split it, they came up with more complicated explanations of who we are, how we exist, that don't contradict that model of body and mind, but explain it a little bit more detail. And 2 weeks ago we talked about the five aggregates. So the first one is just saying we're just body and mind. That's all we are. And we talked about the model of the five aggregates. Can anybody remember what those were? The first one is form, which is, again, just saying body, because that's the less interesting of the two from the Buddhist point of view. And then the other four are feelings.
Perceptions.
Anybody got one written down?
Mental formations.
And what else?
Consciousness.
Yeah. So this is just breaking the mind down into four components. And I'm not going to talk about them in any length. Feeling is I like, I don't like, I don't care. Perceptions is being aware of objects. Consciousness is just the mental experience. Mental formations is everything else. But this is just a way of breaking down our mind, being a little bit more descriptive. So we're going to set that aside tonight. Because then this guy named Vasubandhu came along. He lived in Indonesia somewhere. I can't remember what agent. He said, "Oh, that's way too simple. That list is nowhere near long enough." He came up with this great list called Mind and Mental Factors, which is what we'll be talking about tonight. And how many mental factors are there? 51, okay. In this list, there are various versions, okay. Some lists have 52, some have 57, but we're going to do the Heinz 51 sauce version of this. So, again, this is just a model, a little bit more detailed and a little bit more accurate of how our mind works. And we're starting to deal with the quality of the thoughts that's in our mind, not talk a little bit more about different qualities of thoughts that we can have. So again, we're starting with mind. So we're going to talk about a moment of mind, one of those 84,000 in the finger snap, moments of mind, moments of consciousness, whatever you want to call them. You can call them separate minds even. But say, okay, say, I'm perceiving that cushion there in this moment of mind. How is that happening? How does my non-physical mind perceive this physical cushion out there? Senses, yes, very good, okay. Through our sense organs, as they're referred to in Buddhism. And how many sense organs do we have? That's what we say, but in Buddhism we say we have six, because there's a mental sense organ. Okay, so what's happening is, there is a cushion, my eye, which is the visual sense organ. The light from the cushion goes onto the photoreceptors at the back of my retina, and there's something that happens there, and I'm not going to get into this. Really gets more complex, but okay, that's how it's happening. That's how I'm perceiving that. What's causing me to perceive that? Why am I seeing a cushion there? From the Buddhist point of view, why am I seeing a cushion? Karma. Okay, somebody said karma. That's the right answer. There's a karmic seed that causes that cushion to be perceived by my eye, and at the same time causes what's referred to as a sense consciousness to arise in my mind. And don't get too hung up on all this. This is really complicated and not really that useful at the level we're dealing with. But there is a karmic seed that ripens, and the ripening of that karma is the cushion out there, and a moment of mind that perceives the cushion effectuated or activated by the eye consciousness, by the eye sense organ. Okay, the eye sense organ is not a mind, okay, because the eye is physical, and we're talking about the non-physical mind. So we have cushion out there through the organ of the eye. The mind that perceives the cushion arises simultaneously with the cushion. Okay, that's the, so that happens for all physical phenomena, and for mental phenomena like memories, emotions, planning, non-physical things that our mind experiences, that's the mind consciousness that arises, the mental consciousness through the, there's not a physical sense organ, but that, again, that's something that our mind is perceiving. So along with these perceptions, which are basically referred to, just know the fundamental presence of the object, okay? Before this eye consciousness that perceives cushion, it's just totally neutral. It has no emotional component to it. It's the various mental factors that arise with that moment of consciousness that give it its taste, its flavor, its feeling of whether it's a pleasant experience, an unpleasant experience, a virtuous experience, or a non-virtuous experience. So with every moment of mind, acting through one of the five sense organs or through the mental consciousness, various mental factors arise in combination with that. Okay. I'm just going to outline this a little bit. The 51 mental factors are divided into six groups. Five are the omnipresent. So we got list within list. It's kind of like Russian dolls or something. Five omnipresent mental factors. Five object ascertaining MS doesn't sound real good, does it? I'll just leave that off. 11 that are virtuous. 6 root afflictions. 20 secondary afflictions. 4 variable mental factors. Yeah. Okay. So there are 11 that are virtuous, 26 that are afflictive. Now, doesn't seem quite fair, but that's just the way it is. And 4 that are variable. How can we tell if a mental factor, how do we know if a mental factor is virtuous? I'll just give you an example of one. Non-attachment. Okay, not being attached to something, not clinging. How do we know that that mental factor, if it's occurring with a moment of mind, is considered virtuous or positive? That's a good answer, but there's a more specific one here. Bingo. Virtuous mental factors produce a mind that's calm, concentrated, clear, non-disturbed. The afflictive mental factors create a mind that's agitated, that's non-concentrated, that's not relaxed, that's not calm. Okay, so this is how we can tell if the mental factors are virtuous or non-virtuous. And if we know that our mind is agitated, is stressed out, is unhappy, we know that there's some non-virtuous mental factors present. That's the result of them. That's a very, very good question. Is excitement non-virtuous? I mean, we tend to think of excitement as being good, the more the better, you know, excitement's great. Actually, excitement is considered, in the technical sense, to be a non-virtuous mental factor because it's a mind that's agitated. But we'll go through the list and I'll define them all. I don't know if we'll get to them all tonight. The first 10 are really not as interesting. There are 5, but I'm going to just give them to you so you'll have heard the terms, but I don't think they're really worth remembering. At this stage in the game, okay, I don't have them remembered. I have to work from my notes here. Okay, there are 5 mental factors that are always present with every moment of mind, with every perception. Okay, the first is the one we've always talked about, feeling. Okay, which is either positive, negative, or indifferent. Every perception comes with a feeling, which is basically I like it, I don't like it, I don't care about it, at a very primitive, undifferentiated level, okay? And this is all the working of karma. We don't have any control over this. The next is discrimination. And that's this, not that. You know, this is what allows me to perceive cushion and to recognize what is not cushion. Okay, to perceive that that is cushion, to distinguish that from everything that's around it. There's intention, which is what draws the mind to the object. And don't get hung up on these. There's contact, which is what actually makes the connection between the object and the mind. And then there's attention, which is the factor that keeps the mind on the object. So during even that one of those 84,000 times, your mind isn't wandering off to another object. So these factors are present in every moment of perception that our mind has. For cushions, for emotions, for memories, for planning, for ideas. These will just arise spontaneously. You know, we don't have any control. This is all the working of our karma. Let's go to the question there. Yeah, okay, contact is the mental factor that unites the two, and attention is what keeps the mind on the object. Again, we're talking about just an incredibly minuscule fraction of time, but there is still some degree of attention that is there. Okay? So these five are always present. And every one of those 84,000 moments of mind has these five associated with it. Okay? Mm-hmm. Next we have the five object ascertaining. And these are what perceive the qualities of the object, that in that moment where I'm perceiving cushion, perceives its qualities, okay? But they're not exactly what you'd think from that. And I'm just going to list these and not really explain these because it just gets too wordy at sometimes. Aspiration, appreciation, mindfulness, single-pointedness, and wisdom. But these are mental factors that enable us to appreciate the qualities of the object. And you can get a sense of what they are. Aspiration means wanting to know it. Appreciation means understanding that it has various qualities. Mindfulness means staying with it. Single-pointedness is a further development of mindfulness, and wisdom is seeing reality. So these may or may not be present in the moment, okay? None of them could be present. All of them could be present. Okay, they all, you know, they're all pretty good qualities. They're not necessarily calming the mind, but you can see how they could be really useful if we knew how to use them. Aspiration, appreciation, mindfulness, single-pointedness, wisdom. You know, if it's the teachings of the Buddha, if we could bring these qualities of mind to every moment, that would be great. Of course, if it is killing and stealing, we could bring those qualities of mind to them also. So these really depend on the nature of the object for whether they're virtuous or non-virtuous. Okay? But don't get too hung up on those five. They're not, now we're getting into the interesting ones. Okay. We've got the 11 positive ones. These are the ones that produce tranquility of mind. Okay. The first is faith or confidence. Okay. The next one is integrity. Faith is defined as a mental factor that, when referring to things such as the law of karma, produces a joyous state of mind free from the turmoil of the root and secondary afflictions. So that's very wordy, but it means confidence in something such as the law of karma. Integrity is a mental factor that avoids negativity for reasons of personal consciousness. It enables us to restrain from harmful physical, verbal, and mental actions. Okay, this is sometimes referred to as, and this is going to surprise people, as shame. Okay? This is being ashamed to do certain things. Okay, personal integrity. It's a mental factor that prevents you from doing certain negative actions. Okay, so shame in this sense is considered a virtuous mental factor. Then there is consideration for others. Which is sometimes referred to as embarrassment. We're embarrassed to do certain actions because of our concern for how others might think. That is considered a positive mental factor in Buddhism. Okay. Non-attachment or non-clinging means not overestimating the positive aspects of the object. Non-hatred or love. It's pretty straightforward what that is. Non-closed-mindedness. Joyful effort or enthusiasm. Enthusiasm. Pliancy. That's an interesting one. Conscientiousness. I'm going to go write that all out. Compassion. The wish that others not suffer. Pliancy, flexibility, okay, and equanimity, a mind that doesn't hold some close and push others away, okay, faith, integrity or shame, consideration for others or embarrassment, non-attachment, non-hatred or love, non-closed-mindedness, joyful effort or enthusiasm, pliancy or flexibility, conscientiousness, compassion, equanimity. Those are the 11 positive mental factors, none of which, one of which, or all of which can come with a moment of mental perception. Okay? These all produce a calm, tranquil, non-disturbed, concentrated mind. Okay? And as Chris said, ultimately lead to happiness. Okay, so these are the ones we would want to cultivate. The more these mental factors that arise in our mind, the happier we're going to be. The calmer our mind's going to be, and the happier we're going to be. Okay? So how do we have more of these in our mind stream?
Both the prayer.
Meditation. Creating the karma, good karma, okay? Doing our practices, yeah. But they're not, it's not like we just get lucky. We have to create the causes, okay? This is something that we work on, that we develop, that we train for, so that we cultivate the positive mental factors. And at the same time that we're doing that, we're working on eliminating the disturbing mental factors. I mean, we don't have to, but the Buddha's saying, you know, you'll be happier if you work on eliminating the disturbing mental factors. So eliminate them and their causes. So the six root afflictions, the really disturbing ones, the ones that really upset our mind and cause us to create negative karma and stay stuck in samsara, and they are attachment, anger, arrogance, ignorance, which means not seeing reality, afflictive doubt, that is just not just questioning, but really a negative, closed mind to the nature of reality, and mistaken views. And this refers to things like denying the reality of karma, clinging to a sense of a permanent I, not believing that enlightenment is even possible. Okay, so those are mistaken views. Attachment, clinging, anger, wanting to harm, arrogance, pride, self-conceit, ignorance, not seeing reality, afflictive doubt, you know, just kind of closed-minded, pig-headed sort of doubt, and then mistaken views. Those are the six root afflictions. Again, none, one, or all of them can be present with any moment of mental perception. And then we go on to the 20 secondary afflictions. And they're based on the root afflictions. They're the ones that come from anger. And those are wrath, which is a, you know, really malicious kind of anger. Vengeance. Wish to harm others in return for a perceived wrong. Spite. This is particularly is expressed in how you speak to others. Jealousy or envy. Wanting to take what others have. And cruelty. That's a mind that, you know, is lacking any kind of compassion or kindness. They're the ones that come from attachment, miserliness, complacency, and excitement or agitation. You know, not just joyfulness, but really agitated excitement. Obviously, doesn't calm the mind. And then the ones coming from ignorance. Dun, dun, dun. Let's see. concealment, the wish to hide your faults from others, dullness or lethargy, or foggy-mindedness, laziness, lack of faith, lacking conviction, forgetfulness, that's the opposite of mindfulness. The mind that just wanders from object to object with no ability to concentrate. And this gets real wordy, non-introspectiveness, very superficial quality of mind. Okay. Then there's a couple that come from the combination of ignorance and attachment. I'm just going to put those in here. Pretension. And dishonesty. And then there are ones that come from all three, the combination of all three. And those are lack of integrity. Pretty grim list, isn't it? Yeah, these are the 20 characteristics of a politician. That's right, that's a good one. Inconsideration. 20 necessary qualities for a successful politician. Or to drive on the I-40, yeah. Unconscientiousness. Yeah, however you spell that. And distraction. It's a mind that can't go to any virtuous or positive objects. Okay, so that's the 20 secondary ones. They are related to either anger, attachment, or ignorance, or to both attachment and ignorance, or to all three. Wrath, vengeance, spite, jealousy, cruelty, miserliness, complacency, excitement, concealment, dullness, laziness, lack of faith, forgetfulness, non-introspectiveness. And from the combination of attachment and ignorance, we have pretension, dishonesty, anger, attachment and ignorance together, we get lack of integrity, inconsiderateness, unconscientiousness, and distraction. Okay, these are all, again, one, all, or none can be associated with the perception. You're looking at that cushion. I don't think many of these are going to come up. I'm not going to feel particularly miserly about that cushion. But it's possible. Again, it's a result of karma. It's not like we're choosing to layer these on. They arise spontaneously with the perception of the cushion based on our karma. Okay? But these are the ones that cause our mind to feel agitated, stressed out, anxious. If we know that we're feeling that way, we might want to just look at this list and see what's going on. Or if we know that these are going on, we can assure ourselves that we're going to feel agitated. Okay? So if we want to be happier, we want fewer of these mental factors to arise and more of the positive ones to arise. The Buddha is saying, you don't have to do this. I'm not a god telling you what to do. But if based on, you know, what I've learned about myself, these cause unhappiness. The positive ones cause happiness. Let's see, right here. Non-introspectiveness. Lack of introspection.
What is disgust?
Disgust. Let's see, that would be under ignorance, I think.
When you're helpless.
Hmm?
When you're helpless.
Yeah.
You cannot do anything. You cannot change the circumstances.
Yeah, that's definitely ignorance, okay? Disgust, I think, would be a combination of ignorance and anger. They may not have listed it in there per se. Inconsideration would include some of it, yeah. And I think also under the six root afflictions, arrogance would be connected with disgust. Let me just do the four variable ones. And these are ones that are neither virtuous nor non-virtuous in and of themselves, but depend upon our motivation. And the four variable ones are sleep. Sleep can be virtuous or non-virtuous. Okay. Regret, based on whether it's appropriate or inappropriate. Investigation, looking into something, which can either be positive or can be a distraction. And then analysis, which is similar. I can't really explain the difference between those two. But those are mental factors that could be either virtuous or non-virtuous based on the motivation and the object that they're being applied to. Okay, so that's a lot of talking. And it's not necessarily clear. Okay, and I wouldn't get hung up on the definitions that closely, but just the idea that there are these mental factors in this model are what make us happy or unhappy. And this is where, you know, being willing to sit and look at your own mind and see what's going on can really pay off. Okay, so if we're feeling agitated, unhappy, stressed out, some of these negative mental factors are probably present and are probably present over and over and over again. And you may want to look and see what they are. Okay, questions, comments?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Would it be fair to say that for any of the 20 secondary ones to arise in your mind, you have to have at least one of the six root ones present first?
I think that makes sense, yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's what I thought.
It would be hard to have those without some degree of the first ones, yeah. But again, going back to it, yeah, just the sense perception of the cushion is neutral. It's not a happy experience. It's not an unhappy experience. It's just the result of karma, neutral perception of the presence of a cushion. It's all these mental factors that are applied onto that that determine whether that's a happy experience or an unhappy experience. And His Holiness the Dalai Lama says over and over again, we all want to be happy. There's nothing wrong with that. That is not selfish. Because the way we become happy is by cultivating the positive mental factors. Other questions? Yeah.
Yeah, it looks like all of the secondary afflictions came from three root afflictions or a combination of them.
Yeah.
What about the other three root afflictions? Do they not call
them? Well, these are the three root afflictions.
Okay.
Generally, when you talk about root afflictions, you're talking about three, and it's those three. For some reason, in this model, he added in those other three, and I can't explain that. Okay. But instead of those three, ignorance is the root of the other two, actually, if you want to narrow it down. Anger and attachment ultimately come out of ignorance. Okay. So I can really say everything comes from ignorance, but you'd have to trace it backwards to some of the others first. Okay. Wait for the mic, please.
So back to our point earlier, so basically to get rid of those afflictions would be to, I guess, study, understand, to be able to show wisdom, meditate.
Yeah, I mean, first you have to know they're there, I think. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a certain amount of what we call mind. Okay. The name of the mind and mental factors. Sometimes you'll hear it referred to as low rig. Okay? These teachings in Tibetan are referred to as low-rig teachings. Low referring to mind, rig meaning clear. Okay, so it means clear mind. There's another group of teachings that lots of times you get them confused, and they're called lojong. And that means mind training. Okay? Neither of them have anything to do with lo mein. We're talking about lo rig and lojong. I'm sure people have had some of the mind training techniques. That's when you're already angry. You know you're angry. Here's some antidotes that you can apply to it once it arises. Okay, it's kind of dealing with the problem after it's already there. Really working with the mind and the mental factors. That's, you would start with mind training. You know, dealing with these negative things once they're there. But the ultimate goal is for them not to arise at all, the negative mental factors. And that really comes to working on your karma. Okay, but before we get there, before we can do that, doing prayers, doing analysis, doing meditation, studying the text is helpful.
And I have a second part question to that. So would you say, like, if someone was, like, when they're younger, if they're full of anger, attachment, and ignorance and all of those 20 secondary issues here, would you say that they would be able to, through intensive mind training in this lifetime, get rid of it? Or would it have to be through repetitive karma to extinguish that?
To get rid of it completely, it would be they'd have to work with their karma. But you can certainly do some training. You know, it's like cognitive therapy or something. You can certainly train your mind. You get out of these patterns, these habits of thinking in this way. And this is something we'll talk about in the class on karma. Every time we get angry, not only are we creating the cause for others to get angry at us, we're creating the cause to get angry again in the future. And it said that is actually the strongest way that karma works. Once we act in a miserly way, we're creating the cause to be miserly again in the future. We're creating that habit. So the first thing to do is break those habits. That's what Venerable Rabina says. Buddhism is just about developing new habits, which means changing the quality of the thoughts. Okay, it can seem very difficult initially. Well, actually, it always is difficult. But the ultimate antidote is purifying our karma, so doing purification practice. Yeah. Okay, over here, please.
Dealing with faith and lack of faith, does that mean a certain kind of faith? Or?
Word that's used along with it is confidence. So it's not talking about any kind of blind faith or accepting something because the Dalai Lama said it, or Geshe Gelug, or anything like that. It's always involved with investigation, looking at it, analyzing. I mean, using some of these other positive mental factors. But once you've got to the point, to the decision, not doubting yourself over and over and over again.
So is that combined with right view, or you could have confidence in a wrong view, and that would be...
Yeah, sure, you can have confidence in a wrong view. Yeah, so... You know, you can combine positive, you know, looking at a, you know, perceiving something, a cushion, there can be mixed factors in there. There can be virtuous and non-virtuous ones simultaneously. So, sure, you can have confidence or faith in a wrong view. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very possible. Mm-hmm. Any other questions or comments? This is a lot, okay? And I want you to just kind of think about it. Think about this model. There's the perception through the sense organ. A moment of mind arises that is just direct perception. Okay? Doesn't mean it's accurate, okay? My mind can have a direct perception of pink elephants in this room, which doesn't mean that they're accurate, but it is a neutral perception of pink elephants, and then these mental factors are loaded onto it. We have no control over that initially. Okay, and there are going to be positive ones, negative ones, neutral ones that all go to our experience of that cushion, using the simplest example. But it's the mental factors that create happiness and unhappiness. Ultimately, they're the result of our karma. Everything comes back to karma. Okay, but we can work with them even and start to understand them and start to see what's going on. You know, first we just use this as a tool to analyze our own mind, to see what's there and try and make sense out of all these bizarre thoughts we're having. Then once we've done that, we can start to work about changing what's there. Okay, developing these new habits that Venerable Rabina talks about. So time's up for tonight. We'll get back on this next week and finish up the class and do the completion cards. Okay, thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.